We'll convene the joint meeting of the Finance and Ways and Means Committee, and as everyone knows, the topic of discussion this morning deals with cash flow. But Representative Solberg, do you want to introduce, being that this is our first meeting pages for the Ways and Means Committee?
Yeah, we have a couple of new pages for Ways and Means and for Finance. So Brandon Wurzinger, is that right? Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit of your background?
Sure. My name is Brandon. I graduated from Hamline University in 2008. This is my second year as a page, so you may recognize me, and it's good to be back.
All right, and Jeff Wallner. Jeff?
Hey.
There you are. Want to give us your background a bit?
This is my second year as a page as well. I was on higher ed last year in environmental finance, and I'm happy to be back as well. I also graduated from
Hamline. Oh, Hamlinites, huh? Oh, the oldest university in Minnesota.
And we do have a couple of new pages as well for the Finance Committee. Laurel Vollmer.
She had to run up to the IT department.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll catch her later then. And Danielle Smith.
Yeah, I'm Danielle, and I just graduated in December from U of M with Poli-Sci Global Studies and Data.
Thank you.
So, and this is my first year being a page. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Any other introductions we need from? Okay, with that, we'll catch her when she comes back a little bit later then. Any introductory comments, Representative Solberg?
No, I think concentration today is on cash flow, and we've had several meetings with the commissioner on that, with the subcommittee on from fiscal policy. So I think the purpose today is to have everyone understand the difficulties that we're facing and opportunity to ask questions of the commissioner and the budget director.
Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I know the two chairmen have probably heard us give a similar presentation about a dozen times.
Can I just interrupt and tell everyone to turn off their cell phone, please, because we will be broadcasting this as well.
Including me.
And I'm trying to find mine.
Mr. Chairman, we have, you should have all in your packets a slideshow called State Cash Flow Overview. Mr. Showalter is going to walk through that. Half of our presenters are still not here. Tom Melcher from the Department of Education, I guess, is stuck in traffic, but he was going to be here to talk about the school delay piece. And then Kathy Cardell, our Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, to talk about the RFP for the short-term borrowing. So as the presentation goes on, I'm sure they will show up. Otherwise, Mr. Showalter and I will do the best we can. With that, I will just some opening comments. We, as you will see from the numbers, and as we've talked about since November, with the decline in revenues we have seen over the last couple of years, the state's cash flow situation has gotten to the point where we felt in November we had to inform and educate and make it as transparent as possible the process of tracking the revenues and exactly how much money we have from day to day, week to week in our general fund. And it's out of this, the statutory general fund, that we pay all of our bills. And it is at the point where, even though we are still remain a AAA rated state and considered one of the best investments in the country, we have to and have gone out to at least get proposals for short-term borrowing, Mr. Chair, as we talked about last week, and are going to come back and share what the costs and what the terms are after we get that information. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Showalter, who will start at the bottom of the first page on your slide presentation.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. As the Commissioner mentioned, this is a presentation we have given several times to the LCPFP and the Subcommittee on Budget Balancing. Also have made some presentations even last session. The topic is one that we don't usually come to, and I think it's a really great thing that the joint committees are looking at this topic today. The reason I think it's great is that it is really one of the bedrock elements of how state government works, which is how much money do we have in the bank at any point in time. We typically manage that on a day-to-day basis. We always manage that on a day-to-day basis. What you usually think about and work upon is the biennial budget, which is different than the cash balance, but it's related. The biennial budget is, of course, the revenues and expenditures over a two-year period. Then sometimes we talk about the tails. So we're looking at revenues and expenditures over a four-year period or even beyond. This is really at the granular level, at the most immediate level. And so to just put the whole picture into context is that, you know, we've all known that we've had some four-year balanced budget issues. We also have some very distinct two-year balanced budget issues. Right now what we're talking about is on a day-to-day basis. Do we have the cash in the bank and do these things match up? We have historically not had our revenues and expenditures match up, but it's more acute now simply because we don't have the reserves, our revenues aren't coming in the timeline that you would expect, and or in the amounts that we would expect, and that those things exacerbate the cash imbalance that has always been there. The levels of cash are starting to become low enough that it starts to become questions about how we operate state government and whether we need to get other resources. So with that, let's take a look at the first slide. The weak revenues and budget shortfalls have hurt the state's cash position. When every month Dr. Stinson and the commissioner issue a revenue update, they give you an idea of how much has been collected in that month and how that compares with forecast. That's actually not a very it's a public document, but it's not a particularly well broadcast set of information. But it's important because it starts to give you an idea of what's happening with the revenues and the forecast. And ultimately, it has an immediate impact on what the cash balance is, because that's literally just how much we got in the month in the bank that month. For the last year or two, we've consistently said, gosh, we didn't get as much money as we expected in this last month. And that continues to impact our cash balances. Beyond that, the disparity in timing of revenues and expenditures are the primary drivers behind this cash balance issue. Remember, and I'll go through it in more detail, but just, you know, think about the broad scope of how we structure our payments. We make our local aid payments early in the year. First half of the year, all of those local aid payments are done. Our school aid payments are structured so that they're not just 1/12 over the course of the year. They are structured so that there's probably more payments going on in those first couple of months than there are in many other months. So when do we get our income tax revenues? Well, those are in April and May. So you can just very simply, by those couple of factoids, think about how that might affect our cash balance over the course of the year. When we run low, the commissioner has the ability to borrow from other funds, other state funds, and that is not an unusual situation, though it is unusual to the extent that we're doing that right now. That is part of the commissioner's authorities to manage the state's cash needs, and that has been how we've typically dealt with this imbalance in past years. Looking ahead, a combination of budget balancing actions and administrative actions will be absolutely necessary to avoid external short-term borrowing. What we mean by balancing budget is just simply the kinds of ideas that you're discussing and will continue to be discussing this session to bring the $1.2 billion deficit into zero, as well as other kind of immediate actions that we may need to take in order to make sure that while that lag occurs, that we have enough cash on hand and manage the inflows and outflows on a daily basis. We've gone through this problem a lot more and provided a lot more explanation, and you're going to get a lot of information here in this presentation today. But in case you're looking for more, or in case I maybe just don't quite say everything as clearly as I'd like, there's a wonderful report that we just issued this January that's on our website. It's a cash flow report. It was requested by the legislature, and it provides many of the same pieces of information that you see here, with narrative and additional detail as well. So in case you or any of your constituents want more information, go to our website. We've got a lot more information on this very topic. So that's the overview, cash flow, why we're talking about it today. Great. First slide that we got here is cash balances as of June 30th, 2009. You see here the statutory total line, top line, it says total invested treasurer's cash. What that means is all of the money that is within the state treasury. That includes pension funds. It includes constitutionally dedicated funds. All of those, at that point in time, June 30th, we had about $5.2 billion. That, however, is not all of the cash that the commissioner has at his disposal to manage the state's cash needs. Law clearly states, and accounting practices clearly state, that they're really what we have is a statutory general fund, which is more of our operating funds to work from. That balance at that point in time was about $2.4 billion. Some of the major funds that are included in there are the general fund, health impact fund, and other funds that are listed there. It includes a health care access fund, Minnesota State College and universities. It does not include the University of Minnesota. They're outside of the statutory general fund. They have their own set of accounts. There are lots of many smaller funds as well. And you see the balances with each of those funds are listed in that first chart, totaling about $2.4 billion. Those funds, that statutory general fund, is the reference point for most of this presentation. While we typically in budgetary discussions talk about the general fund, in cash, when we're talking about cash management, the daily cash management, we're really talking about all of the funds and what the balances are there. As you can see on the bottom part of the page, those numbers move, and they can move significantly. By November 30th, as expected, the statutory general fund balance had dropped. And it dropped from that $2.4 billion to about $834 million. As I mentioned at the very outset, there are seasonal factors that impact this quite predictably. And as we anticipated, they did draw down those balances to around $834 million. Within that, why did it go down? Mostly it's the story of the general fund. And I'll get into more detail later in the presentation. But mostly it's the story of the general fund and its imbalances. So that while it had $41 million, as you see on this chart, as of November 30th, the only reason it had $41 million in balances was that we had borrowed $945 million from other funds.
Would you repeat that again? That's a key sentence for the whole discussion.
That as of November 30th, the general fund had $41 million in it. The only reason it had a positive balance was that it had already borrowed $945 million from other funds. Put another way, it was negative about $900 million as of that point in time. That $900 million came from other parts of the statutory general fund. Through accounting transactions, we simply looked at where we did have cash, where parts of that the cash balance were, part of that $834 million, and made sure that we kept and maintained a positive cash balance in the general fund. Now, during that day, I remember quite well, we were watching very closely because $41 million on the entire state enterprise isn't a lot of money. And November 30th, December 1st, was like, okay, do we only have a couple of more places that we can borrow from fairly easily within the statutory general fund. You know, we were watching it very closely. Robert Erickson, who's here in the audience, is working on that on a moment-by-moment basis. And Charlie Bielek is also here. And you know, they are very much watching what was happening. As it turned out, as we expected, around December 1st, we did start to get some into the tax revenues in, and that balance started to rebound. But you know, in the morning it was around 40. By the afternoon, we had gotten over to $400 million. That's the kind of variability in the day-to-day changes and timing that's really important here on cash balances. I want to just digress for 1 second from the cash balance because, you know, one of the contexts is, you know, how unique is Minnesota? And what I'm just putting up here is a simple chart. I think the graphic, you don't really have to look at the details too much. It's a GAO chart. And they put together a couple of charts just talking about state governments generally. I started talking about this about a year and a half ago. And this figure shows state and local government operating balances as a percentage of GDP. And you can see about midway through the graphic, you get to about 2010. And you can see that states in aggregate started to have negative operating balances and that that was really likely to continue. The pressures that we're seeing here in Minnesota are not all that unique. States as a class of government are seeing significant pressures due to the recession, declining our revenue streams, and healthcare costs increasing our overall expenditure rates well beyond what our revenues are growing at, or not growing, as the case may be. So, you know, GAO was just looking at this as a long-term trend and saying, well, what's expected to happen? And the cash crunch that we're looking at here and the budget crunch that we'll be talking about in the coming weeks is just part of an aggregate picture. And I thought this was just a useful context as you think about this and try to look at what's happening in other states generally. So bringing us back to a little bit closer to currently, we talked about November 30th going down to about $45 million in the general fund. By December 31st, that balance had bounced back up to about $224 million with about $870 million in interfund borrowing. So, you know, where before it had been about $900 million negative, by the end of December, you know, it was about $650 million negative. That's the kind of, again, volatility that we're talking about. The borrowing, the interfund borrowing between funds is shown in the bottom part of page 3. The general fund has borrowed funds from other, cash from other funds in the past decade. Going back to 2001 and 2002, the budget was in pretty good shape. We had large reserves, or we had at least fully funded reserves. Our revenues were coming in higher than anticipated, and we weren't doing any interfund borrowing. By 2003, however, that had changed. Had about $850 million in interfund borrowing.
Excuse me, Representative Coles.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On this, Mr. Showalter, this is not just unique to this decade, though, correct? I mean, it goes back to the 90s and the 80s. This has happened repeatedly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we were trying to get that research together. I can't say definitively. I do not expect that we were borrowing in the late 90s. And prior to that, there was an accounting transition where we went from MAPS to the earlier statewide accounting system. And I don't have easily accessible data on what the interfund borrowing was at that point. We think there was, but I can't tell you for definitively.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, Mr. Showalter, on page 2 and 3, just so I get a handle on what's happening in Minsky, when you're borrowing and then the borrowing, I guess, is a smaller figure on page 3, is it because of dollars coming in and Minsky depositing them in the reserves, or because you paid back?
Excellent question. I should have clarified that. When Minsky has balances, cash balances, they're deposited. We're like their bank, essentially. When the general fund is borrowing cash from Minsky or any of the other activities, that money still earns interest as if it were still with Minsky. And it is repaid to that that account within that fiscal year. And that's always our assumption. So it's not really a harm to Minsky for that interfund borrowing. And it's really just a matter of their balances go up and down based on their payment streams, on their tuition collections, on how we pay our state aids to them. They have their own mini cash flow situation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
I didn't understand the response. Is that so? That $34 million difference there, where there's $34 million in December, was it because of tuition payments or above what they needed to pay their bills, or was it because you deposited the interest made off what would fictitiously be $420 million back into the account?
The balance we've been trying to maintain on $200 million cash balance in Minsky. That 180 was the low point. As I said, basically the balances do vary based upon other revenues that may be coming in. or in I think in this case, we ended up putting some money back into that account to make sure that they had a $200 million balance. But the balance, trying to think of how to get at the...
Can I interrupt? If you look at the two balances, minuscule from the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3, the 180 is their cash on hand as of November 30th, and the 214 is their cash on hand on December 31st. But the difference of borrowing is you went from $300 million from them on November 30th to 225 on December 31st. So that's a $75 million difference, and their cash increased only $25 million. So does that mean that their expenses were going out as well? Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, well stated. Yes. Okay. There's multiple things going on there, and you're absolutely right. Some of the balances that had been borrowed were returned, but then the net is that there were all their expenses that were going out that clearly were in excess of their revenues.
Well, Mr.
Chair, the net is a daily changing balance in Minsky's account. Just as you would see changing balances in all of the other funds on a daily basis.
Representative Covina.
Well, so, you know, Mr. Chair, and I guess Commissioner Hansen, would the governor see this as, you know, the fact that tuition now is in many of the Minsky campuses is paying for about 55% of the bill and even 60% in some of the campuses, and you know, the dwindling amount of state general fund money that's going to Minsky, and I believe it's like $180 million less than they got in the last biennium. Do you think you're taking money from the students, or do you think you're just taking money from Minsky? Who's, I mean, I would consider most of this reserve money to be tuition increases, and so does the governor feel comfortable taking money from these students who are being charged huge increases in tuition, and then some reserve is being put aside to pay for bonding or whatever they have to pay for now on this upcoming session. Does he feel comfortable doing this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, when I met with Laura King and Minsky officials in October, and when we talked about our cash flow management, I specifically asked, how much do you need to carry on your business? And we were told $200 million. And so we managed to that with the low point you see there at 180. But that, from what we were told, allows them to pay their bills and do everything they need to do. But we asked them, what number can you help us? How can you help us? What number allows you to do the work you do without infringing upon that? And that's how we arrived at the 200.
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
You know, Commissioner Hansen, I always hate to ask you the tough questions because you're a pretty nice guy.
Oh, come on, you do too.
You know, but you didn't answer the question. You know, it's easy for people to make $350,000 a year at the central office or 200 and some thousand to say they can live with this, but it's not very easy for somebody that's unemployed and being charged extra tuition to pay the tuition. And I think that's where this reserve came from. So not only are you shortchanging we as a legislature, and we're certainly partly to blame for not standing up to the governor, but now we shortchange them on the general fund, and then they get charged extra tuition, and they put it in this reserve so they can live, and we take their money away again.
Well, we pay it back with interest, Representative Rukavina.
Yeah, checks in the mail. Okay, I'm done.
I think they...
Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I, in meeting with them, we are told that they are able to meet their obligations. We are allowed statutorily to pay back the money with interest, and relying on the assurances that they gave us.
Mr. Scholl, in terms of how to proceed, would you prefer to take questions as we go? I know the commissioner has to leave a little earlier, so that's one of the reasons we're allowing questions. maybe we should take advantage if there are questions while he's still here, at least temporarily. Oh, excuse me, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for either testifier. The slide that you put up that wasn't in our packets that purported to show that other states are basically in the same boat, I saw the caption as being something like, it was something like operating budgets as a percentage of GDP.
Yep.
But that's not really the same, is it, as what we're talking about here today? I mean, that shows kind of in the aggregate states. How many states do you know are in our same situation of not being having enough cash to pay the bills? Not the aggregate, not the trend, but how many states are in our situation right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent observation. This is one of a couple of factors, as I mentioned at the outset. You know, basically, declining revenues is sort of a leading indicator that declines your cash balances. The point that I'm only trying to make here is that states in general have seen significantly declining balances, have probably been using up their reserves, and certainly those pressures are not anticipated to ease anytime shortly. It's not directly a cash chart, and you're absolutely right. It's different than a cash chart. There will be some information, I think, that we'll provide a little bit later about states that are directly borrowing cash from the markets and external borrowing, which would be, you know, directly analogous to states running out of money going to the markets for cash. So we'll get you a more apples-to-apples comparison in a second. They're already copying that chart, so we'll provide that in a minute.
Mr. Chair, we do have a list as a result of our meeting the other day when the speaker asked the question, a list of the, since 2008, of the other, states in the country that are short-term borrowing, and I think that's being handed out now. It gets to Representative Simon's question.
Continue on.
Sure. And yes, yeah, so if you any other questions, we will happy to take them, because the slide on the bottom of page 3 is where we left off. Just looking at historically, that there has been interfund borrowing within the general fund from other funds over the course of the years. Most of the years, that borrowing really came from the health impact fee, the health care access fund, the special revenue fund, the major funds that had balances. To a lesser extent, it came from Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. What you'll see here, starting in 2003, in the recession earlier in this decade, we started borrowing at a high point of about $850 million. In 2004, that figure came down sharply to only $200 million. It is entirely related to the fact that we had a $1 billion tobacco endowment fund that we had been borrowing cash from, and part of the budget solution of that year was to move that into the general fund. So we no longer had to borrow from that fund. It was already part of the general fund. And even with that $1 billion infusion, we still ended up borrowing $200 million from other funds. You can see as we worked through that, 2005, that borrowing continued to come up. And then as the budget situation stabilized, as we started to rebuild our reserves, we started to lessen the amounts of interfund borrowing. Unfortunately, that steady state really only happened in 2007. And then the numbers started going back up. In 2009, the high point was a borrowing of $950 million. We've already nearly reached that point this fall, with a borrowing of $945 million. And that's even with some of the administrative actions that we took to slow down some of the revenue refunds. And I'll get to that more in a little while. So the situation that we're in right now in terms of interfund borrowing is as high or higher than it's been in previous years. And it's likely to go even higher, stretching, truly stretching, and probably exceeding the amounts that we have in balances.
Mr. Showalter, you mentioned this is in addition to the administrative things you've done, which has been slowing down the mostly the tax refunds that are due to corporations and individuals. Yeah. On that amount, what is the total amount that we are borrowing from or not paying back in a timely fashion, which we would normally do? I know this fall, I think it was $120 million.
Mr. Chair, I think the give or take $5 million, was about $150 million in corporate and sales tax refunds that were delayed. All of those have been repaid since then.
Mm-hmm.
So starting in later in December, we started to unwind that figure so that by January, we were back onto a concurrent basis.
So the figure that we have in 2009 or 2010 fiscal year 2010, the 945, there's additional monies that you have borrowed on that that is being paid back. Is that correct? About $150 million?
Mr. Chair, it's sort of an if, but for not doing those administrative actions, we would have needed to have come up with another $150 million beyond the 945 that we already were borrowing.
Very fine. Thank you.
Okay. The next page, on page 4, it points out one of the sources. I've been referring to the statutory general fund up until this point. Within that, I mentioned general fund and other funds. This is really just looking at the general fund. And the declining balance in the general fund is really part of the actually, I think this is still a statutory general fund figure. Pardon me. But the declining balance is really leading to this. You see that year after year, the starting balance that we have has been going down. So that while we've been balancing the budget, interfund transfers really don't help our cash position, or using those as part of our budget solution. Year after year, we're starting at a lower point. That exposes the differences in timing of our revenues and expenditures, leading us to some of the cash management problems I'm going to get into more in the details. On the bottom half of the page, let me just explain the format. This is looking at the statutory general fund for 2010. The vertical bar shows by month the high point, the low point, and the ending balance for that month. So the high part of the bar shows you the balance, the highest balance. The low point shows you the lowest balance. The crosshatch is the ending balance. So, for instance, in July, you see that the high point was roughly $2.5 billion. The low point was about 1.7, and the ending balance was a little bit higher than that, maybe 1.8. As you go through the course of the year, that balance starts to decline fairly quickly, recover a little bit in the middle of winter, and then go down more markedly in the middle of the spring before coming to June. The ending balance in December and November was around, or the low point was around that $400 million mark, around $500 million before recovering. That was, again, even with the administrative actions we were taking. What we're looking ahead to is in February, and particularly in March, April, and May, those low points within the month drop below $500 million. In fact, one month drop below zero. And you can't manage below zero. And in fact, it's difficult, somewhat impossible, to manage to 100. We're really looking at $400 million being the necessary working capital for the state. That includes MNSCU, that includes all the other activities in the statutory general fund, to make sure that things work on a fairly smooth basis. That would still mean significantly, it's still more interfund borrowing than what you've seen so far.
Mr. Showalter, as a point of clarification, All these numbers include all the funds, not just the general fund, but the statutory general fund.
So yes.
The MNSCUs and the others of the world.
Mr. Chair, that is Brian.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, do these numbers reflect us borrowing from the school districts, or this without the borrowing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. This is not reflecting delays in payments to K-12 schools or higher education or some of the corporate tax refunds in the administrative plan that I'll get to in a little while. This is really the cash flow estimates prior to any administrative actions. And that's why you see the March, the April, and the May figures being so low. And that's why we were talking with the LCPFP and the LAC in recent weeks to get a plan together to manage through that.
So those are before your fix?
That's right. That's restated again on page 5, looking at the low points during those months, with $400 million being the estimated working capital needs for all of those activities. We needed a roughly $550 million of options in order to manage through those statutory low points, both to keep things working and also just the fact that these balances vary significantly on a day-to-day basis, and that these are not, repeat, not certain, you know, that although we have good ideas what our revenues will be in the next couple of months and what our spending will be in the next couple of months, that is still based on the economy, on taxpayer behaviors, the timing of all of these activities. So there's a lot of risks that are all built into these figures. The 2011 outlook is a separate and worse cash management problem. As we look ahead, this is based on the November forecast, so it is not providing a $1.2 billion budget solution. We're not making any assumptions as to what that would be or how that would impact these cash flows. But we see very clearly that we drop to a negative balance even in August of calendar 10, and continuing with negative balances through most months, all the way up until May and even June. That is the low points are lower than what we're trying to manage through in fiscal 10, and they're more persistent. So when Assistant Commissioner Cardell comes up, you know, we'll talk about the different types of strategies and issues that these two different kinds of problems present to us.
Mr. Scholder, can you tell us, you know, we all know that at least based on November that there's a $1.2 billion shortfall. So whether we resolve that with cuts, revenue, combination of cuts, revenue, how would that impact the cash flow once we resolve that?
Mr. Chair, good question. The cash balance really reflects the amount of the solution and when it occurs. It doesn't really matter whether it's spending cuts or new revenues. It just matters when that action will be received and really show up in the state accounts. So if it's a $1.2 billion cut in spending that all was scheduled to go out on July 1, that would raise the entire graph up by $1.2 billion. Or if it was a $1.2 billion revenue that occurred on July 1, it would do the same thing. Most of the time, though, these things have impacts throughout the course of the year, so it's really not going to be so dramatic. It's going to be little by little by little, adding up to $1.2 billion only until you get to probably the month of June. So it's not going to raise those low points, and the timing really matters.
Okay, Mr. Scholder.
I've been talking about the general fund, specific statutory general fund. For a moment, we're just going to dive in within the statutory general fund to just the state's general fund. And here you see negative balances that Representative Solberg mentioned before, that the general fund's low balances and negative balances are causing those interfund borrowing and really causing the declining statutory fund general balance, statutory general fund balance. The low points are explained a little bit on the bottom of that same page, where you look at the timing of our revenues and expenditures for that fund. Expenditures start to exceed revenues right away in July, and by the time we get through September, we've used significant amounts of money, both in the K-12 area and the local aids and credits area. A couple of months where you see significantly more revenues, or December and June. The June in particular is related to not just getting the statewide general fund, statewide property tax revenues in, but it's also the June accelerated sales tax coming in. By getting the June accelerated sales tax in, you get to count it in that biennium, but then what happens in July is, well, what do you know? You don't collect the sales tax in July, and we spend more than we receive.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shorter, do you have that next draft? What would it look like in July of 2010?
I don't have that graph, but I have the data. I think maybe even further in this presentation.
Okay.
Continuing ahead, I've alluded to this a few times in this presentation. It's just the volatility and unpredictability of cash balances, that they can change, and they can change significantly. And so the commissioner and the department really are looking to make sure we minimize the risk of a bad surprise, of not being able to make payroll, of not being able to make a school payment, not being able to pay our vendors on the day that we really are expecting to make those payments.
Can we have a question? Or
please.
Representative Emmer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, and this is more of a general question, these are all, we're talking expenditures, expenses, and revenues here. How about our debt payment in a cash flow type of setting, our debt payment cash flow? How does that affect? We're talking about a bonding bill again this year. Can you tell us about, is there a certain time of year when all those bond principal and interest payments go out, or is it spread throughout the year? Can you tell us where that might be reflected and what the impact of a bonding bill this year might have on cash flow?
Representative Demmer, I wonder if we're going to get into that a little bit later in the agenda, if you could just maybe hold on that.
Okay.
Unless you have a very quick response, but that was one thing.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, the quick answer is we make our debt service payment at the end of November, and we prepay for 18 months. So it's a one-time payment, and as you see on the charts, that's why we dip in November, because we make the big debt service payment on all the debt we have as a state. Mr. Chair, that's the quick answer.
Okay, and we'll be getting into our discussion on the relationship of the bonding a little later. Representative Showalter, or Mr. Showalter.
No.
You're representing the department, I guess.
Mr. Chair, I can do that. And chart on the bottom of the page, just again, shows you the volatility of the balances. I mentioned, around the time of that debt service transfer, we were expecting to move out, I believe it was about more than $400 million from the general fund to the out of the statutory general fund to the debt service fund. That really caused the low point in the months of November and starting in December, that very large one-time payment. That is the kind of volatility, and we can manage that piece, but, we don't know how much Medicaid is going to be paying or what our payments are going to be through the HMOs in 2 weeks from now. We have a good idea, but it can vary. We don't know that, there's going to be exactly what the collections or the withholdings are going to be next month. We have a good idea. But the variation and the volatility there starts to drive the different cash balances. To the solutions, short-term actions in 2010 include holding one payment to the University of Minnesota for 2 months. The authority under that is 16A-152, subdivision 7. That payment would be held 2 months and then repaid later in May. To school districts, MS-127A-46, change in payments to school districts. Tom Melcher is here, and we'll talk through that a little bit in more detail. And finally, tax refunds, looking at the changes in being able to not pay corporate refunds immediately, but holding them up to 90 days as allowed in statute. The result of those administrative actions is shown here. Hopefully your slide is better than what you see in the overhead. But it really is a recap of the same figures that you've seen before, that revenues and expenditures through February and June lead to low points, including a negative 143 in April. The changes that we're talking about, along with some updated information on exactly what is likely to be going to school districts during these months, lead us to a better low point, so that we have roughly $400 million during this period. And that should be enough for the state to manage through the fiscal 10 low points on cash basis. That's the administrative plan that the commissioner forwarded to the LCPFP and the LAC, and we've talked about and would be happy to get into more of that. And really, that's the transition to, I think, the next set of discussions.
You want to, for the next set of discussions, then focus on each of your three solutions separately, or how do you want to approach that? Because I know you have Ms. Cardell here to comment, as well as Mr. Melchert from
Why don't we have Ms. Cardell come up while the commissioner is here, and let's talk through the LAC discussion of a couple of days ago. Would that be
sure? I wonder if we can have a little bit of clarification on your estimated update low school payments December through June. The $150 million that's reflected in that line.
Yep.
From Mr. Melcher or somebody that would be
able to. We're going to get them all up here.
Okay.
So if you want to start with that one,
okay.
Why don't we I think the preference would be to start with Mr. Melchert then.
Mr. Chairman, I'm getting to the point where I have to leave. Did you have any other questions? I'm sure it won't be the first time I'll be back.
Well, just to,
for this august group.
I think you're back next week.
Yeah, next week, that's what I was
saying. That'll be more fun.
Are there questions maybe before Commissioner Hansen? He gave us a heads up that he would have to leave about 10 o'clock. So, well, Commissioner Hansen is Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hansen, I understand this is all short-term borrowing and cash flow, but my understanding is we really don't, it's going to be hard for us to do anything until we see the governor's budget. Do you have an idea when that's coming out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, one of the reasons why I have to leave, I think incredibly shortly thereafter the State of the State, which is on Thursday.
Hours or days?
I don't, it's up to him, but it's incredibly shortly thereafter.
Thank you.
It was my understanding that, in fact, we have it on our agenda that next Monday we will have the governor's budget before this joint committee, and
that would mean we should get it out on, that's an incentive for us to get it out on Friday.
That's right. Yes. And what it would do is give us a chance to review it prior to the hearing on Monday. So
right.
If we can stay on that timeline, that would be most helpful.
I can just advise on the date, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
I said I just advise on the date.
I understand. Yeah.
Representative Swales had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good to see you, Commissioner Hansen. I have a question related to school districts and their fund balances. I understand that there are some rumors out there that if a school district has a healthy fund balance with $351 in excess of that per pupil unit, that there might be some consideration of school districts with that kind of fund balance turning that over to the general fund. I know that that has been expressed to me as a concern, and I'm just wanting to know if indeed there is some truth to that rumor or if it's simply a rumor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, that is a transition into the next segment, which is to walk through in more detail the slide on the top of page 8. And what you're referencing is the school district's piece of that slide, the middle one, 127A46. It was a statute that was passed bipartisanly in 1986. I think a few members of this committee were around then, but most were not. And it came interestingly, if you look back at the legislative history, with the Republican House, a DFL Senate, and a DFL governor, and it was after the recession, the 80-81 recession, and the difficulties in the early 80s in the borrowing at very high interest rates. It led the legislature and then governor to abhor bonding when you're paying double-digit increases, which is why I think in the context as we all study and found this statute interesting to keep it in that mind. Now, of course, is a different time period, a different day, different interest rates, different set of circumstances, and that's what Dr. Melcher is here to walk through.
Representative Swales, is that? Did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stay tuned.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to say I had some people do some research on when that was passed, and while it was passed bipartisanly, all the ones who voted no, and a lot voted no, were Democrats, and the bill was authored by two Republicans. So it seems to me we had this borrowing instead of taking care of business coming out of two Republican authors even back then. And I'm hoping that as we go forward in this session, that we can, when we get the governor's budget, that the borrowing, the one-time solutions, and according to an article I read in MinnPost recently, Minnesota is the second state, only to Alaska, in this one-time borrowing and one-time fixes, which is not a solution, at all. And so that's why I'm working on getting rid of that borrowing from schools business, because I think that will force us to have to balance our budget honestly and authentically and not just keep borrowing from local governments and raising property taxes.
Well, and it was signed by a DFL governor, Governor Perpich. I think Representative Rukavina would hate it if he were considered a Republican.
Commissioner, it's now 10. Before you leave, you know, there's always that danger in the one last question. But, okay, why don't we, you said this was a good transition, so.
Thank you.
Mr. Melchert is at the table, so welcome to the committee. And thank you. If you want to delve into then the withholding of payments to the school districts, and I suspect there may be a number of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education. You have a number of items in the in your packet that are related to the delay in school aid payments to the school districts. There, I think, for starters, you have the letter from Commissioner Hansen to the governor and to Commissioner Segrin, dated January 26th, which is reviewing the state's cash flow estimates and advising the Commissioner of Education that we need to delay $423 million in state aid payments under Minnesota Statute 127A. 0.46. There is a spreadsheet with fairly small print that is describes the details of the calculations that were done by the commissioner under 127A. 0.46. The statute specifies a formula which establishes a maximum amount of state aid payments to school districts that can be withheld under the statute, but then gives the Commissioner of Education some discretion to reduce state aid payments to schools by a lesser amount as needed to meet the state's requirements in terms of cash flow. And in this situation, the maximum amount that could have been withheld under the statute was greater than the amount that was necessary to meet the state's cash flow requirements, and so there were some adjustments made to take a smaller amount in terms of payment delays than what would have been allowable under the law. So I'm not sure if you'd like to have a walkthrough of the calculations or what would be your preference, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, why don't you do as you proceed with at least hitting the high spots. But my question is on a little bit as on the $150 million that appears on page 8 of your thing. That's a, when you add up 62, 31, 26, 23, and 7, I think it's about $150 million on that one. And that's the lower school payments, December through June. Explain that a little bit, and then the other question is, will that be picked up in the forecast?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, the lower school payments piece relates to the timing of school payments that we make based on estimated data that we receive from school districts, as opposed to what the timing of payments would be if we look at the data that are used for the forecast. Quite often, especially in years when school districts are negotiating teacher contracts, their estimates of pupil units are a little bit lower than our estimates of the pupil units that they're going to have. And so we make our aid payments during the course of the year using the pupil unit estimates that we that we get. So the school districts fall a little bit behind in terms of their cash flow during the year because we're paying them based on the number of students that they estimate that they'll have. They're often quite conservative and don't want to be making it look like they're going to get more money than they're actually going to be getting. And so as a result of that, there is some impact on the cash flow. It ends up going out a little bit slower, and I think that line is reflecting a difference in the timing of school aid payments based on the probably incompleteness of the data that we've received as we make the payments during the course
of
the year.
So, Mr. Melcher, that helps your cash flow, but it doesn't help your total payment at the end of June or July whenever you make that final adjustment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silberg, that's correct. We do make our final adjustments in August, September, and October.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I checked with one of my superintendents, and he said that they have to have accurate data on each month put into the system. So I was a little surprised that some of them are underestimating when the one said, well, we have the accurate data put in every month.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silberg, it varies a lot among school districts. I think some districts keep a much closer watch on that than other districts do. We require districts to submit estimates of their pupil units to us before the start of the school year, and we encourage them to update them regularly. However, some districts do that more often than other districts do. And we also have quite a bit of aid going out based on estimated expenditures for special education. Some districts may not have all of their teachers identified as claiming reimbursement for them at this point in the year. Some may not have updated them for whatever the results of teacher collective bargaining are, so they may have old salary data rather than new salary data. There are a lot of factors that drive state aid payments to schools, and I guess I would say some districts are right on top of it. Other districts may be a little behind.
The reason I ask the question is a long-term question, because the law says right now if a school district has $350 per pupil unit, I think is that the right number, that you can take above that for your cash flow purposes. You have, in the administration, have the governor's determined $700 and above. If the cash flow problem becomes more difficult, then you will have to, under current law, go down to the $350 and delay some additional payments. So are the reserves that the school districts are reporting to you accurate then, based on the inaccuracy of the data that you're getting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silberg, we're using two different years of data here in the discussion. The calculations under Minnesota Statute 127A46 are based on last year's data. So it refers to $150 times the number of resident pupils in the preceding fiscal year, or later on in the calculation it refers to $350 times the students in the preceding fiscal year. So we have good data at this point as to the 2008-2009 school year, and that's the basis for the cash flow adjustments. And that's different than the estimates for the current year.
Okay, Mr. Melcher, then it may be a little bit more difficult to have accurate what the school district reserves are in the present time that you're holding back payments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silberg, that's correct. The statute calls for us to use the final audited data from the prior school year. We know it's accurate, but it's not timely.
Okay.
And so a school district's current cash position could be significantly different from what we're using in the calculations, but we're following the statute in terms of using prior year data.
Thank you. Okay.
Not that it makes any difference, but we went through our own transition. Representative Solberg will be in the chair for the balance of the meeting, being that it's a co
okay,
chairmanship today.
Continue on.
excuse me. Mr. Chairman and members, I don't want to belabor the information in the spreadsheet, but maybe if I could just refer to a few of the key columns in this calculation, just using the Aitken School District, which is the first school district on page one of the report. So what this shows is that the the unappropriated operating fund balances for the Aitken School District. That's a good choice then. The Aitken School District were $4,198,000. So that's what they had as of June 30th, 2009, based on the audited financial statements that we've received in December of this past year. The school district had a fund balance then, based on their 1,422 pupils of last year, $2,953 per pupil unit in fund balance as of June 30th. And that's used for part of the calculation. The statute says if the fund balance is less than $350 per pupil unit that we cannot make any cash flow adjustments in those districts. That statute was written in 1986, hasn't been adjusted for inflation. The Commissioner of Education, in reviewing the calculations and knowing that we could get by with less than the maximum withholding, elected to use $700 per pupil in the calculations rather than $350, so we're not making any cash flow adjustments for any districts that have a fund balance of less than $700 per pupil as of June 30th of 2009. The next part of the calculation has to do with cash and investments, and in the case of Aitken, they had $4.5 million in cash and investments, and they were not in short-term debt. The statute calls for us to use the net cash and investments, where we look at what we've got in cash, but then we also subtract off any borrowing, so we're looking at the net amount that they really have. And in this case, the district had not borrowed any money, so that we're just using the $4.5 million as their cash and investments. Then the statute says that we can only make aid with withholdings for the eligible districts for those that have more than $150 per pupil in cash and investments. Again, because of the fact that the state needed to withhold less than the maximum allowable under the law, the commissioner elected to use $700 per student in cash and investments as a cutoff rather than $150, so that protects the districts a little bit more. The goal here was to protect the districts that had the most difficulty in coping with this situation and wherever possible to prevent the situation where the districts would have to do short-term borrowing of their own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, if you know what percentage of the districts hit the $350 mark and what percentage hit the $700 mark?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I do not have that calculated here. We do know that there were 231 districts that are subject to this withholding out of 337 school districts. So that those would be the ones that are over the $700 on fund balance and also over $700 on cash balance. But I haven't calculated how many more would have been included if we had used a lower threshold.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we do is we subtract off any portion of that cash balance that's attributable to the first half property tax settlement that they're going to be using for their expenses during the current school year. We're already subtracting that off for purposes of aid payment metering, so if we didn't subtract that off, we'd be counting it twice. So in the case of Aitken, out of their cash balance of $4.5 million, $183,000 was really money that they had received just in May and June from their tax settlements that we're going to exclude from the calculations as well. So that leaves us, in the case of Aitken, with $3.4 million that could have been subtracted off at the maximum. And then we looked at the actual payments that they have coming. And we looked at the period of time in which the state was short on cash, which is March and April primarily. And you can see that the payments to the Aitken District were $350,000 March 15th, $421,000 March 30th, $280,000 on April 15th. And what the plan here is to do is that we're going to reduce all of those payments, which would be a total of $1,052,000 of withholding for the Aitken School District, which is under the maximum that we could have reduced, which is $3.4 million. So that's the way this works, and the payment, the restoration of the $1,052,000 would be on May 30th after the state's cash flow improves to the position where we can pay it back.
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
And just as one additional point of information, Mr. Chair and members, I did provide, just for your information, a copy of the memorandum that went from Commissioner Segrin to the school district superintendents, just describing this calculation. It was something that wasn't in your packet that I had distributed by the page. That I won't go through that in detail, but it describes the process that we went through and also provides school districts with information on the appeal process. There is a provision in the statute which allows for an appeal, but it's a very stringent set of requirements, so we don't think that, given the fact that that we have limited the withholdings to school districts that are in pretty good financial shape in terms of over $700 cash balance and $700 fund balance, that the type of districts that we're taking money from would be likely to qualify for an appeal. The appeal is really designed for school districts that are in statutory operating debt or very close to it. So we think that won't be a major factor.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question or two. When the school districts are reporting their fund balance, is there a distinction between what may be encumbered and what's unencumbered? What does that number show relative to what obligations may be out there shortly after they've reported?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the school districts are operating on a modified accrual basis. So if they've incurred obligations and haven't yet spent the dollars, those are reflected in their fund balance. So the statute looks at both fund balance and cash balance. So it's kind of looking at one would include encumbrances, the other wouldn't include encumbrances.
And the other question, keeping that in mind, then will any of the school districts that are impacted be forced into short-term borrowing? Have you gotten any feedback in that regard, being that they may have encumbered fund balances to some degree?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I haven't heard a lot directly. Just from reading the newspapers, I know that there are a number of districts that said they will not have to do short-term borrowing, that they will have interest losses because they may have to cash in some investments. But I've also heard St. Paul, for example, has said that they will have to do some short-term borrowing. And I've also heard that there are some cases where the school districts, while they wouldn't necessarily have to do short-term borrowing, they may find it more financially advantageous to do some short-term borrowing for a month or two because they may have a smaller loss than they would if they had cashed in some long-term investments and lost the interest for the whole year. So we have some of both going on.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Melcher, thank you. Mr. Showalter, want to continue on? Where do you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, if we may, if Kathy Cardell, Assistant
sure.
Commissioner, could come to the table. What we've talked about here are just some of the short-term actions, and the majority of those short-term actions are the school district payment delays that Mr. Melcher just discussed. I'm going to leave that up there just for one sec. The other two that are very much smaller, one is the $50 million in delays in the University of Minnesota payments, and again, extending some delays in the tax refunds for corporations and sales taxes. We talked about administrative actions and balancing the budget necessary to help ease our cash flow situation. There's another option, and that's just the short-term borrowing option from external sources. And so Assistant Commissioner Cardell can talk about, sort of recap some of the discussion with the LAC and just some of the options that are there as well.
Okay, welcome. By the way, just a point of clarifications on your tax refunds. Are the administratively going to try to hold back personal income tax refunds, or are you talking about the corporate sales tax refunds, that type of thing?
No, Mr. Chair, just corporate refunds.
And when do you start having to pay interest on those?
Mr. Chair, 90 days.
After 90 days?
After 90 days.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner for Treasury and Debt Management at MMB. I think since a lot of you have not been participants in either some of the LCPFP budget balancing subcommittee or the LAC, I'm just going to take a second to talk about this kind of external source of funding, which is certificates of indebtedness. Just to give you a little background and a little context, the authority for the state to issue short-term obligations resides in Article 11, Section 6 of the Constitution, as well as in Minnesota statutes, Section 16A, 671. Essentially, there are four different opportunities or tools that the state can utilize that are identified in statute. The first is to advertise for competitive bids. That would be a full public offering of a fixed amount of short-term certificates with a fixed maturity date. The second tool would be to negotiate a line of credit with a bank. The third would be to negotiate a contract with a firm or firms of underwriters to purchase the certificates or to act as an agent in the placement of those certificates. And finally, the fourth option is to sell certificates of indebtedness to the State Board of Investment without advertising for bids. As you would expect, there are advantages and disadvantages with every one of these options. and I will, in the interest of time, unless people want me to go into more detail about that, I'd like to focus on the two options that the department has identified and has, in fact, discussed with the LCPFP as well as the Legislative Advisory Commission last week. I think you have in your folder a little one-page summary, a table, that is it was actually addressed to the LAC, but it provides a summary overview of the request for proposals for either a line of credit or a private placement of certificates of indebtedness. And I'd just like to
Have people find it.
Find it. Yeah. Little one-page MMB logo at the top. Looks like a table.
And the label is MMB?
It's got the logo right at the top.
This one right here?
That's it.
Everyone find that? Very good. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. The basic terms and conditions. I should back up. This was done, again, for the LAC from last week. And after that meeting, that was on Wednesday, February 3rd, we issued the request for proposals on Thursday, February 4th. So we'll talk a little bit about the calendar or that sequence of events here in a minute. But the amount that's identified in the request for proposals is not to exceed $600 million. The purpose is to increase the liquidity of the state and smooth out the fluctuations that Mr. Showalter was talking about, which can be pretty dramatic from a day-to-day basis when we look at forecasted state receipts in conjunction with disbursements. The security for these certificates of indebtedness is the state's full faith, credit, and taxing power. It is a general obligation of the state, just as the state issues general obligation bonds for capital projects. The source of repayment for any certificates, they are payable from collections of taxes levied for and other revenues appropriated to the state's general fund during the current biennium, which ends June 30th, 2011. We structure these short-term certificates so that they would mature no later than the end of the biennium, but in the event, depending on our particular cash flow situation, and we'll talk about that in a second, we have allowed for quite a lot of flexibility from potential respondents because simply we're trying to manage a lot of risks, much of which I think it's difficult to know what's going to happen. So I'm going to skip down to the line on the table that talks about flexibility. The RFP has been structured to allow for potential respondents to bid on providing a line of credit. That's the bank line of credit that we've talked about as one of the tools. A private placement of the certificates or both. A private placement of the certificates or both. There are some financial institutions that will be better suited to a line of credit option, others that might be better suited to a private placement, and still others who would be capable of doing either one. Furthermore, we have allowed potential bidders to offer both a taxable and tax-exempt structure. And the reason for that is that under federal tax law, we can only issue tax-exempt certificates if they have a maturity of 13 months or less. So when we were devising our plan for how to go forward with this, we were looking at the cash flow situations in fiscal year 10, which hopefully are now going to be managed by the administrative actions. But if we were to issue certificates, let's say, in February or March of this year, we would have had to have those mature within 13 months, and that would have not been a very good time to do this when you look at the cash flow that was projected for fiscal 11, where we are basically only positive in the statutory general fund in July, tiny little bit in August, and then not again until June of 2011.
Would that be amortized then over the 13 months, or would there be a balloon at the end?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, with these sorts of short-term certificates, with a line of credit, we would expect that we would be paying interest monthly on whatever amount we might draw. We would have to pay it back in full, whatever we've drawn, at the end, whatever the final maturity date is. With a private placement, same thing, although it's more the way that the private placement would work as opposed to the line of credit is that we would issue the full amount up front, begin to accrue interest on that amount immediately. Most likely those would be issued at a fixed rate, and then we would again have a principal and interest payment at the end.
Okay, so we would have a balloon, as I would call it,
right,
using the
right.
Home mortgage
correct.
Approach as an example. At the end of the 13 months, we would have to pay $600 million
plus interest.
At point plus yeah. interest.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Cardell, I don't quite understand your flexibility that you have between taxable and non-taxable. My understanding is that you want the authority to put out a request for a proposal now. And you want that to be able to, in case in fiscal year 10, even though we assume that the problem for cash flow is solved by borrowing from the school districts and so forth, withholding some of their payments, but your request for a proposal would be available, let's say, in March of this year or April of this year, which would then kick in past the 13 months that you'd have. So how can you manage between a request for a proposal that says, are you going to get two if you have to borrow this? This is what it's going to take, and if it's taxable, this is what the interest will be? Or if it's non-taxable, if you don't have to access it, is that what you're intending to do?
Mr. Chairman, we really are, yes, trying to offer the broadest range of options depending on circumstances that may or may not happen. One of the advantages of a taxable product, particularly with respect to a line of credit, is that we can borrow and repay and borrow and repay and not have each of those constitute a bond issuance or a note issuance for tax purposes. That is a great deal more flexible than a tax-exempt line of credit might be. And so when we were contemplating this originally, we were looking at there being sort of a two-pronged problem. The first was how to manage through fiscal 10, in which perhaps a line of credit was the most attractive, and then see what happens with the legislative session and the budget situation and the impact on the cash flows, and then reassess to see where we are at for fiscal 11, which if we are able, in fact, to manage through this fiscal year as we are contemplating that we will, you're right. The taxable option may not be necessary. But from my perspective and from MMB's perspective, we thought it was very useful to get a full array of the potential level of interest, costs, et cetera, for both taxable and tax-exempt options.
So, Mr. Cardell, when you get a response for the request for a proposal, mm-hmm. you may not necessarily accept them.
Correct.
And what if the financial market changes 4 months from now, mm-hmm. and you've got this request for a proposal, and then they say, oh, wait a second, you didn't access it right away under this terms. I don't want to go down. Would you then have to reissue, or is this a binding request for a proposal from financial institutions?
A very good question, Mr. Chairman. The proposals themselves are valid for a minimum of 120 days okay. from receipt. And so that's the first thing. We can also extend upon mutual agreement between the state and whoever the selected firm is. And in terms of the value of the information that we get, you know, let's say when these proposals come back this month, We are anticipating that the proposers are going to give us an indication of interest rate that will be tied to some sort of an index, perhaps as a percentage of LIBOR, for example, for a taxable rate, or a percentage of what we call the municipal market data index, which is a daily rate that comes out, which even, you know, 3 months from now, we can calculate what that cost would be based on the then market conditions.
Okay. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cardell, is all of this discussion, though, academic until we hit that $150 mark on the under 127A46? I mean, I'm reading the letter from bond counsel here, and do we have to hit that number before this is even an option for the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, if I may. Yes, the current law specifies that we need to avoid cash flow borrowing and must use those education payment delays to the fullest extent before we would be able to go to market and get a clear sign-off from the bond council. So if our situation becomes worse, we would need to use additional administrative actions before we would go to market for short-term borrowing. That being said, there are certainly just plenty of risks around that notion of whether that law has changed, whether the timing of these payments become disadvantageous, you know, if it becomes a late May kind of problem. Again, we're trying to deal with a number of different risks and make sure that the legislature, the governor, and the state generally has options no matter what comes, whether it's a April surprise and refunds and all those kinds of things. We want to make sure you still have options.
And Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I actually support this effort to fully understand what it's going to cost. I just want, I mean, it should be clear to all of us that we don't even get to talk about short-term borrowing unless we either change 127A in the next couple of weeks, or we get to the point where we have to further delay aid payments.
Well, Representative Coles, except for one thing, the law of the borrowing from school districts cannot be done in July, August, or June, July, and August, I believe it is. Or is that correct?
That's correct.
And so we have a cash flow problem there that we may have to access this particular line of credit or type of thing. Okay, Ms. Cardell, come on and continue on.
Sure. you'll note also on the summary that we talk about something called a single agreement. We intend to enter, if we need to use this tool, into an agreement with a single provider, but we have also allowed for a lead institution acting as an agent for other institutions that would be acceptable to the state. That, again, is partly because the financial markets have, let's just say, made it more unclear that financial institutions, very large banks, would be capable or willing on their own to accomplish something of $600 million. So they participate that agreement out amongst other financial institutions, potentially, again, trying to make sure that we have encourage as many institutions to participate as we can, not just limiting it to those very, very large institutions who would be potentially able to do the entire amount, if necessary, on their own. We have noted the criteria for selection here, pricing, their willingness to accept our terms and conditions, as well as their related experience in offering these types of products, preferably to states. And then we've noted a time schedule here. We did release the RFP on February 4th. The responses, though, we did move back the due date from the 18th to the 25th, since in the near term it seems as though we have in place the administrative tools to manage through the next couple of months, and we didn't want to jeopardize the quality or the number of responses by asking them to respond more quickly than might be normal for something like this.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, when you were talking about the criteria for selection, mm-hmm. you mentioned that that you were interested in smaller organizations as well as larger financial institutions, correct? Not just the very large ones.
Yes.
And are there other limitations? Like, are there limitations in terms of whether they're foreign or domestic or located in Minnesota or other states?
Ms. Cardell?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, there is no prohibition against a foreign institution participating. However, they are required to complete the disclosure that would indicate to the extent any of their work is outside of the United States. I think that's a Department of Administration procurement requirement. And so they will be required to disclose that.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cardell, would that, if there were to be foreign purchasers here, would that be something new to the state of Minnesota, or is that continuing? Are we doing that now?
Ms. Cardell?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, you know, to the extent that this ends up being a tax-exempt transaction, which if we are, again, if able to manage through Fiscal 10, and if we do need to do something to manage cash flow by using an outside event like a cash flow borrowing, would very likely be the case. I think there's very limited value to foreign entity purchasing tax-exempt paper. In terms of the state's outstanding debt, most of what we do almost exclusively is tax-exempt. And so to my knowledge, although there's literally thousands of individuals or institutions that own state debt, I don't know that there's any foreign holders. I'm not sure what the advantage would be for them.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you want to continue on?
I think that's the end of the summary of the RFP. Again, just to recap, we did release it on the 4th. Responses are due on the 25th. We'll be interested to see what we receive.
Ms. Cardell, maybe you can clarify the procedure, administrative procedure, for you to be able to accept these now. We had an LAC meeting that gave us information, and that was an information one, but can you give us an update on the procedures that will be necessary for you to be able to access money,
yeah,
if you want?
We would be going back to the LAC in the event that there is a need to utilize, because of unforeseen circumstances or other circumstances, a need to use short-term borrowing. The only thing, as we talked about in the LAC, Mr. Chairman, as you'll recall, is that it could be a fairly short notice. But Senator Pogue-Miller was ready to talk on a Thursday afternoon for a Friday crisis, if necessary.
Okay. Other questions at all? Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and maybe you know the answer, but is the LAC meeting, is that advisory, or do they have to approve it? Or does the commission have authority just to do this if they deem it necessary?
It is advisory. They have to seek advice, but it's strictly advisory.
Yes. Representative Carlson. Mr. Chairman, going back to that $600 million that would be due at the end of the 13 months plus interest, Mr. Showalter, you began to talk a little bit ago about risk factors. And, of course, now that's a new incoming administration, whoever that might be. What are the risk factors with having that $600 million available for payment? And what would happen if there wasn't enough cash in the bank at the end of the biennium to make that payment? One could argue that this administration is kind of kicking the issue down the road to an incoming administration that's going to have a balloon payment, as I call it, at the end of the biennium. So what are the risk factors there?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Representative. I think there's a couple of different factors here. One is, you know, the requirement to have a balanced budget. So it is a little bit separate from just balancing the budget. This is a cash management tool, and you know, our current projections do, even without the $1.2 billion budget balance, suggest we have cash by the end of the biennium. It's also a tool that, you know, other states use, so it's not exactly unprecedented for states to try and find some short-term ways to manage their cash flows during the biennium. If that is context, now, the fail-safe on this or any other general obligation type debt is a statewide property tax. So the state is already a AAA credit in two of the three rating agencies, so they already know we're in better financial shape, better financial management practices than most other states. And even failing that, we've got our debt backed up with basically a pledge that we will go get the money in the event that the economy continues to go south. that our ability to pay these bonds isn't there, we would basically back that up with the tax receipts.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the full faith and credit, but then at a future administration, though, is going to have to plan one way or another for a $600 million plus interest bill that will come due at the end of the biennium. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we do it, I mean, part of the message here is to give you options to help you understand the choices.
No, I understand, and but I'm assuming that...
Assuming we go down the path... Assuming we go down the path for short-term borrowing?
It looks like we're going to have to when we look at 10 out of the next... Or in fiscal 11, 10 out of the 12 months are going to be negative. Mm-hmm. We're going to be in the red for cash flow purposes, so... I'm assuming you're going to have to do something here to get through 11. But the current administration leaves office at the halfway point there, so there's 6 months that remains. And so a future administration, regardless of which side of the aisle they come from, is going to have a $600 million issue potentially that they're going to have to deal with one way or another. So my question was the risk factor. Now, let's hope we don't have to levy, as a result of that decision, a statewide property tax to cover that debt. So when I'm asking about what the risk factors are, I'm asking you how comfortable you are that barring going to a statewide property tax, we're going to be able to have enough cash in the bank to pay that $600 million plus interest at the end of the biennium.
Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am fairly confident that, you know, we've got a plan to start to manage that those risks. I think this discussion, though, is really useful because I think all of us need to understand the options and budget balancing and how they interact with cash, and how they increase or decrease those risks, and also watching the revenue forecasts and whether we're getting more risk or less risk. A year ago, every successive monthly forecast that we got from our national forecasters was worse than the worst case scenario from the previous month. That isn't happening now. But if that were to start coming up again, now I think this state and other states would all be in a really bad situation on a cash basis and on a budgetary basis because of the amount of flexibility that we have to raise revenues or cut spending quickly is, you know, pretty limited. So I think right now we're giving you very plausible, very, I think, responsible plans. But we've also lived through an extraordinary economic period. And we're trying to make sure that we cover as much of that risk, giving you some options and tools, and we'll keep in touch if we start to see things, new risks, and particularly big risks along the way.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted, for mostly for the members here, just to clarify something that was stated earlier. It talked about the 1986 legislation that allowed you the ability to borrow this money or delay the payments to the school district. It actually didn't happen in 86. In 1986, it was a one-year bill. It was continued in 1987 under when Governor Perpich was still governor. But the Democrats took control of the Minnesota House then. And it was actually enacted with a fully Democratic majority in House, Senate, and Governor that did this, what we're doing.
Well, no, that,
I think there's a little more history to it than that. I think Representative Greiland has done some research on that, if she would care to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, the Senate author and the House author were Representative Mary Forsyth, Republican from Edina, and Senator Bill Schreiber, Republican from Brooklyn Center. And we'll be happy to know that Representative Solberg voted against this. I, too, have that vote.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I guess he knew back in 1986 or 7 that he was going to be the Ways and Means Chair, and he didn't want that on his chest. You know, the main thing here is not who enacted it, but who's actually, for the first time in history, actually going to do it. You know, to have a lot of tools to prevent yourself from going off the cliff, is, you know, something that all of us who plan ahead want to do, but I actually think that rather than save ourselves from going off the cliff by pillaging the K-12 students, we should be planning ahead with a fiscally responsible budget that balances ourselves and follows our state constitution, which says the state should be the ones that provide that thorough and efficient education that's equitable for all students. And so I don't want to get into quibbling the historical details. For heaven's sakes, we might get Representative Seifert in here, and then we'd all find ourselves in trouble because he's the true historian with all these details. But the bigger point here, I think, is not who enacted it, even though it was Republicans, but who's actually implementing it for the first time, and that's Governor Pawlenty.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carl, one point of clarification, we're going to continue on. Representative Carlson.
I think that there was also a change in 1994 under the Carlson administration, changing it from a May to a shall.
Right.
So I think the very early comments, without getting heavily into this debate, that it was a bipartisan decision under two different administrations, one Republican, Carlson, earlier under Perpich, a Democrat. So we can spend a lot of unnecessary time on that bit of history, but it does have bipartisan history in terms of the enactment of the law.
I want to continue on with the discussion now from the witnesses, if you would, please. Any other things that you need or any other questions directly towards the discussion that we're having? Representative Aver.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just to remember something that was brought up earlier, there is a $1.2 billion projected shortfall in the coming biennium, which is, they said, is not built into the cash flow. However, that gets reconciled, and there could be any one of a dozen ways to go about doing that. And so there may be, you know, some change in this projection, just to remind people. And so it's
Representative Aver, I don't know if you were here, that was a question that was asked early on, and it will help, but it depends a little bit upon timing and what kind of fixes. We still may have some cash flow problems depending upon, you know, if we cut out all payments to local units of government, as an example, that will help cash flow because those payments won't be made then. So it depends upon the fix, but if we may still have a cash flow, it'll help, but we still have to worry about the cash flow that's in the bank. Any other questions on this right now? Well, then I want to try to get out of here 11:30, but there is another topic that we should probably have a little discussion on, and that is on the question that Representative Demmer requested earlier. And so if you would give us some how the state manages its other fund, which is the bond fund, Ms. Cardell. And Representative Hausman, if you'd like to come up in case if you want to ask a question on this, please join us at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, the impact of the capital investment bill on state cash flow is that, well, it's a couple of things come into play here. First of all, the members should know that the existing bond proceeds that are there, which last week when I checked this number, it was about $430 million in a separate.
Would you clarify what you mean by existing bond proceeds?
I will do that. Whenever the state issues bonds, we go through a very lengthy and detailed identification of cash flow needs by legislative citations for capital projects. And in fact, we send to the legislature we send to the legislature a notification of our intention to issue bonds, and we attach, and probably in the past, very little attention was paid to the attachments, which go into some great gory detail about what is being proposed to be issued for the projects themselves. When we sell bonds, those proceeds go into a bond fund, and those proceeds can only be used for those projects that we have identified by legislative citation when we issued the bonds.
So, Ms. Cardell, you cannot take the $400 million that's in existence right now and put in the general fund.
That is correct.
Okay.
And so the way that the state has managed that is in 16A 641, you know, once a capital investment bill is enacted, those appropriations become available. As a practice, I think a very good practice, the state does not sell bonds in the midst of legislative sessions for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about in more detail. But 16A 641 has a provision that allows the state to borrow from the general fund, the cash in the general fund, and then reimburse the general fund with bond proceeds once those bonds are issued. And so that's exactly what we did, for instance, back in the fall of 2008. Some of you will remember that the financial marketplace was in turmoil. We could not sell our fall issue of general obligation bonds. There was, at least on the part of some people, a great deal of angst over that, because how will capital projects come to an end? No, because what we did was we borrowed from the general fund to make sure that those projects continued, and then when we were able to sell bonds in January of 2009, that general fund borrowing was reimbursed. So the impact, Representative Demmer, of an early capital investment bill is that it could, depending on a number of factors, it could have a debilitating effect on the state's cash flow position, because we cannot use existing bond proceeds. You know, if projects are truly ready to go at the drop of a hat, then we have a situation where we need to take that money from the general fund.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. That was an excellent explanation. I think I understand that. Another question I have, and actually the real question I had, that was great. That's not something I was thinking about, but I'm glad to know that.
Well, no one else, Representative Demmer, is very happy to know that.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that angle. I guess what I was wondering about is we issue bonds. We have to make payments on those bonds, right. Principal that's and interest, mm-hmm. that come into our cash flow. It's not typically, payment on debt is not part of the budget. It's part of cash flow. I'm curious about the cash flow implications of a bonding bill for repayment, maybe not this year even, but in the tails, and what that may do to cash flow. You know, we talk about putting a big bonding bill together so that we can create jobs and get money injected. Well, we have to pay that money back, and that's going to impact our cash flow in the future, and I was just wondering if there's projections about that.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that answer is really depends on how those bond payments in the future are situated with the rest of the balanced budget. You know how there will be more outlays for debt service next year and the year after that for larger bonding bills. It just depends on what other revenues and expenditures are baked into that budget. So in terms of a cash flow, it would slightly increase that November debt service payment, moving money into the debt service fund, but it's really not probably as much a cash flow issue.
Representative Demmer, we also have to realize that as payments are made, other payments are coming off as well, and the state manages its cash flow, you know, with upfront payments as well.
Yeah.
That's usually done in the bond sale itself. So it is an issue, but I don't know as if the management of the cash flow is the biggest issue of that particular part. Representative Clark.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I stepped outside. I might have missed the prelude to this, but I think you were kind of maybe asking there at the end. So you got the debilitating effect on the cash flow, but what about the positive effect of the jobs being created and that whole thing part of the economy? Is somebody trying to balance that out and looking at it in terms of a time phase?
Mr. Showalter, do you want to try to take that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative. I think what we're talking about is, on a daily basis, what are the cash flows? And you know, when a payment is going out of the state for a contract, whether it's currently general fund expenditure or some other expenditure because we're lending money out of the general fund for a capital project, you know, that's day one. We know what that cash impact is. I understand interest in getting those projects going, but you know, those jobs will not have an immediate impact on the tax revenues, and it certainly won't be the same size as that payment going out. So it's not like a $1 in capital projects is going to yield $1 in tax revenues. And that is really the equation we have to manage to right now. Do we have enough money in the bank?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark?
Well, I think what we have to manage here is also the immediate effect on the individuals, on the people we represent. If they have a job, that's a real change in their life compared to just looking at the state's checkbook. So I'm just wondering if anybody's really trying to balance those or trying to look at that. And, we have all these different silos, and you're in one, but we have the folks out there who need the job and the income right now.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's why there's a debate. We're trying to help you understand the financial implications of what the state treasury has and what's going on. Understand that there are other things to balance for the bonding bill, and that is certainly the prerogative of the legislative process to figure out to balance.
Ms. Cardell, when we pass a bonding bill, even though we say projects are paint ready or ready to go, usually there's a process that we have to go through to get all the paperwork done. And I'll just pick out on something simple like the local bridges. Counties then would, if we had an appropriation for that, counties would have to submit their plans and so forth. What is the length of time that it takes from the time that a bill is authorized until all the paperwork is done for those type of projects?
Mr. Chairman and members, it varies, of course, from every project. We, for our own bond issuance planning purposes, and I know some of you have heard this before, we assume that when there's a new capital investment bill that's enacted, that about 15% of that bill will go out in the first year, about 30-35% in the second, something similar in the third year, and then it kind of trails down in the fourth and fifth year after that. Last year, again, we 2009 was not a normal bonding bill year, but we had a larger than a normal kind of off-year bill, and those dollars went out a little more quickly, about 26%. So that's not, it's not half of it, but it went out a little more quickly. I would just say, as a general rule, local projects take longer. There are usually matching funds that have to be brought it to bear and so forth, and those tend to be the longest.
You have to have a project agreement,
yes,
done with the local units of government.
Right.
And so when you say longer, is it normally like 2 months to do that, 6 weeks, a year to do that? And I know there's no one size fits all, but give me some ideas on that.
Mr. Chairman, I've been here I think exactly now 2 years. And I would say, just based on my observation, it looks to me that it's usually 1 to 2 years by the time everyone gets their various ducks in a row.
I understand everyone, but how about what's the length of time for a local project, a road and bridge project? I mean, there's work done on it. They're on the list already for that paperwork to be done.
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't know. I think it's faster.
Okay.
That's a program that has established application, right, procedures and so forth, administered by MnDOT. So I think they have a pretty good routine of getting
it. If you could do some checking on that, I'd like to have information. And Representative Holbrook?
To that point, does the 26% that you spoke of from last year's bonding bill, does that include trunk highway bonding as well, or is that just GO bonding?
It was basically just the GO bonding. And when we, again, for those of you that haven't heard me talk endlessly about this, when we sell bonds, we literally survey every state agency that has an open bond appropriation, capital appropriation. And for some agencies, that's hundreds. And we ask them to forecast their cash flow projections for the next 12 to 18 months. And then we utilize that information for purposes of identifying the project citation that we're funding, and also for helping us to size a transaction. And so the 2009 bonding bill was not a real, I think there might have been a tiny little flood trunk highway piece or something in there, but that was, for the vast majority, was what we call our various purpose capital projects.
All right, thank you.
Representative Swales?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not about bonding, so it may not be relevant at this point.
Well, okay, let's see if there are any other questions for clarification. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, it's great to see you again. I missed you.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I haven't had a conversation like that until this week, and when my wife said the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, our co-chair's here.
Both of you.
Nice to see everyone. I'm in a good mood today.
Good to see you as well, Representative
Russell. Ms. Carl, you mentioned about the not issuing bonds during session.
Correct.
Is that in statute? Is that in rule? Or is just a general behavior of the?
It is. It is not in statute or rule. It is a practice because we have, whenever we sell bonds, we are required to present a full and complete disclosure of the state's financial condition, which during a legislative session is very difficult to do. Commissioner Hansen is required to sign something called a 10B5 opinion in order to sell bonds, which says our disclosure is we're not precluding something that's material. The problem with the session is that a material event can literally happen the week after we sell the bonds, and then that is potentially a difficulty for our bondholders who just purchased bonds based on information that was accurate a week ago but now is no longer accurate.
Mr. Chairman, if I may. And Ms. Cardell, so I would assume then that the factors that go into that sort of thought process during a general session would also apply if there was a special session going on?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Additionally, though, we did have a bond sale in the last legislative session in Alice, is that what
January?
You
want
to join us?
January 2009, at the very beginning of the session, which was an extraordinary event because we basically had 1 week. We wanted to get the bonds sold that we were unable to sell in September, October of 2008. We had to squench it in between the November forecast and the February forecast. And so it's true that happened in January, and we were very, very glad that we were able to do that, but I will point out it was right at the very beginning of the session, January 13th.
Representative Hausman?
Mr. Chair, I did want to make that point that just last year we did it during a very difficult session when it was very unclear where our budget was going, and it was a very successful bond sale.
Ms. Cardell, let me ask a question. I should know the answer to this, and I don't. You put the documents together for an October bond sale, and the market just wasn't. You didn't want to go out in the market. I understand. When you put it on in January, the first week of session, it was between the November and February forecast. Did you have to revise?
Yes.
Your documents to reflect the November forecast?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We would have to revise it after the February forecast. Then we would have to revise it again after the end of session, whatever that may bring.
Well, but there was a huge difficulty, a downward revision from at the February forecast last year. But the bond sale was actually pretty successful. It kind of was dynamics that are kind of difficult to explain sometimes.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes it is better to be lucky than to try to time it.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Yeah, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, the witness, what do you mean by successful? And I guess maybe I haven't heard you say, Representative, Mr. Chair, maybe you can answer that, or the witness, whichever, or both.
Ms. Cardell, maybe you can identify that.
Sure.
I think everyone that says it was successful, including
Mr. Chairman and Representative Westrom, we had multiple bids. I honestly don't remember how many. It was more, I think maybe six,
five,
seven, six, something like that. So we had a large number of bidders. The interest rates were very competitive, just a little bit north, I believe, I recall, 3%. But interest rates were very comparable when we sold bonds this past summer in August as well as again in October. Interest rates are, as has been pointed out by numerous folks, quite low, continue to be quite low.
So I think the term of successful was that there was very great competition for the sale of the bonds.
Yes.
And the interest rate was very, very acceptable.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, that's essentially, that we're saving money in versus if we only had two people And when we're talking people, we're talking probably institutions that do a lot of financial investment. But to contrast that, it would be unsuccessful if you only had a couple parties bidding for the bonds, and what they do to examine the process for myself here as a committee member and maybe others. You could have ended up with 4% money versus 3% if you wouldn't have had a lot of people involved. Is that am I interpreting that right? Is that part of what successful is called here?
Ms. Cardell?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, you know, we were really concerned at the time we did that sale in January of last year because there had been a real contraction in the number of broker-dealer firms that were participating. I mean, you might all remember Lehman's and Bear Stearns and all people that would have in the past bid on the state's bonds, potentially. Mm-hmm. So we did not honestly know what to expect, and we were very pleased that we still got a very, very good number of bidders at interest rates that appeared when we looked at it against others that were in the market at the same time to be very, very comparable. So, but you're right. Sometimes when you have fewer players that are interested, that can certainly skew the rate that you receive.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative West,
last question. Explain to me the process a little bit further. Do the different players have to give their best offer right away, or is it like a potential reverse auction where they have a chance to lower their offer? I mean, they might come in at 3.9 and others are as low as 3, and some do they have a chance to change it? And the follow-up to that is what if the rates were coming in at 5% or 4.5%? Do you ever scrap the sale and say we just don't think we're getting good enough interest rate offers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Westrom, the basic process, you've got a pretty good handle, it sounds like, on the basic process when the state sells its general obligation bonds competitively. What we do is we prepare a disclosure document. We're just talking about that. We make it available on our website and other, more broadly, a couple other websites that are accessed by potential bidders and investors. We set a time and date specific when folks are to submit bids for the bonds. They have to take all of the bonds or none of the bonds, so they don't get to parse, you know, I only want 100 million of the 400 million or what have you. That occurs via the internet electronically. They cannot see each other's bids, although they are able to literally change their own bid right up until the last seconds before the appointed time for the bidding to close. So it's not an auction.
Those bids aren't posted before the bidding.
That is correct. They cannot see each other's, nor can we see them. Yes, nor can we see them. It's only after the appointed time. You know, I can't tell you whether or not the state has ever rejected bids. I know it from, not since I've been here in this position. I know that in my past professional life, when I worked with other states and local governments, that there have been occasions when we rejected bids, and we have that capability in the terms and conditions of the offering. And it was almost always, well, two factors. One, either the interest rates just were not market rates in our view, and we were not willing to accept that, or also, when we do refunding bonds, which I think some of you have heard about, we try to, achieve interest rate savings on our debt, reduce the debt service transfer for those bonds. A lot of issuers have criteria for which, you know, if they don't achieve a certain level of savings, they just won't do it, because typically you only get one shot at it under federal tax law. And so there have been circumstances where issuers have rejected bids because they couldn't meet their savings criteria. I hope that helps.
Okay. Any follow-ups, Senator? Is that it?
Well,
okay.
Mr. Chair, it is a helpful. I guess that's it for now.
Okay. Representative Swales, you had a different question, and we skipped over you now. Do you want to ask that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it really maybe is for Mr. Showalter, and it has to go, it goes back to probably page 2. I just wanted to talk about the Health Care Access Fund. Mm-hmm. And it shows quite a drop, and I guess my concern is I have a lot of physicians in my community who have talked to me about this, and they're very concerned about the provider tax that has been in place since 1991, and they now feel like that it was a dedicated tax towards the Healthcare Access Fund, and now it's being used to support the general fund. Is there anything that we can look at to be able to justify that one particular segment of providing revenue that it should go into the general fund when it's being it was dedicated for another purpose?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, our representative, a good question. And I think that same issue is here underneath all these other funds, that we have separate funds for unique purposes, Health Care Access Fund for the Minnesota Care and Health Access generally. The Minscu funds, you know, for higher education in one particular system. The same is true in many other places. You know, in the special revenue fund. Special revenue funds. Things are going down all over. each of these accounts are for a non-general fund activity, and there's some reason that this legislature dedicated them to be outside of the general fund and the non-dedicated sort of choices that are there. I think because we're borrowing on a short-term basis, we're really borrowing the cash that's available in the fund. That's very different than, you know, the budgetary questions that the physicians you're talking to are probably referring to, and the transfers between funds, those kinds of issues. The cash basis is really just a matter of, you know, on a daily basis, making sure that we are keeping the accounts active and running. Since we are returning the funds within the fiscal year, since we're returning interest that was earned in those funds, yeah, I don't anticipate that being a significant concern by physicians in the community. I think the overarching question here is just, you know, what are the balances that we have in any of these funds, and, you know, do we have enough cash across the board to make it through? We can go on a lot further about Health Care Access Fund, General Fund, what's the appropriateness, growth in health care costs generally. But if we're talking about just cash,
that looks like separate issues. Topic for next week.
Yeah.
As we receive the governor's budget, right? Okay, any other burning questions, Representative Holbrook?
Mr. Chair, to that point, if for some reason the governor's budget doesn't come out till Monday the 15th, are you going to allow for some time for people to digest it before? I mean, I didn't see any confirmation, hard confirmation from the administration that they're going to meet your proposed timeline in your letter.
Well, Representative Holbrook, it's not our proposed timeline as much, but it's been kind of a mutually agreed upon timeline. It isn't just us. If by chance they don't make it, we don't have a budget to be presented, and we're not going to hold a budget and hearing and have everyone look at each other around here. We will manage that time well. And the purpose of scheduling on the 15th Monday is because we've been fairly well assured that they would be ready on the 12th. And then that would give us the weekend to be able to have 4 or 5 days. If by chance they don't do that, we will absolutely take your suggestion. We're not going to come in without having some kind of an opportunity to look at it as well. Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chair, just so people understand the background, there's already been somewhat of an informal extension. The Subcommittee on Planning and Fiscal Policy that Senator Pogemiller and I chair, and Representative Solberg serves on as well. Originally, there was conversation about having the budget available before we were even in session, and that didn't happen, and we've been working with them. And so the latest suggestion, the way I had interpreted it, came from the administration that the governor wanted to wait until he gave the State of the State, which is on the 10th or 11th, The 11th, and then that the budget would be made public the following day, and that would give us the weekend to review it for that meeting that comes on the 15th. So there's been a fair amount of back and forth already in terms of what the timeline is. But a lot of that fits into what we're talking about right now, Representative Holberg, the whole question of using time to our advantage as we begin to move forward in balancing the budget. Every month that goes by gives us less time to make whatever those adjustments are, and the bigger time frame you're able to spread whatever the decisions are over is helpful as we move into the future.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I can't find it right here, but the only correspondence that I was able to see was that letter from the two of you to Commissioner Hansen laying out a timeline, and so I didn't see any real buy-in from the administration. I heard we'll give it our best shot here at the stand today.
Representative Holberg, we sent that letter. We didn't hear a letter back from the them. That was, I think, the third or fourth letter that we've had to the administration. We have had conversations with Mr. Hansen and Mr. Showalter as well, and we were assured that we'll try to make that 12th date. In fact, as that was their suggestion, and we said, well, if that's the case, then we'll go on the 15th. We did not post the agenda on that for another week, I think, and then we said, after we wrote the letter, to have the hearing on the 15th, expecting budget on the 12th. We waited another week before we posted it, and we were confirmed last week from Mr. Hansen directly. He said, post it for the 15th. Now, if by chance something doesn't happen, that doesn't get met, we will understand it, and we will postpone the Ways and Means. So stay tuned. We will allow the flexibility that needs to be allowed. But we want to also get on with the process, because I know this isn't easy, and it's not going to be easy once it hits this committee and all the rest of the committees as well. This isn't going to be fun. We do need to get working on it, and I think they recognize very fully that time is money from their perspective as well.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a couple of announcements, and then we're about ready to wrap it up.
Chairman, I have three, one of which we've already been talking about, but if Laura Vollmer could stand. You were out of the room when we were introducing the pages, but you were doing work. So if you could just very quickly tell us what your background is, as the others did.
But what's your major?
My major is political science. My minor was communication. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, that's about what the other said as well. They didn't give you a heads up, though, that you were going to have to do that. Huh? The other thing, Mr. Chairman, the next meeting of the Finance Committee is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. Wednesday night. And we have two items on the agenda, House File 2700, Representative Hausman's Omnibus Capital Investment Bill, and then also House File 2680 by Representative Aaron Murphy, which would modify the General Assistance Medical Care Program. So those will be before the full Finance Committee. And just as we were talking, per the agreement that we have with Finance, we will be hearing the budget in a joint meeting on the 15th at probably starting again at 9 a.m. I don't know if we've set the exact time yet, but or 10:30. Okay. We may adjust that a little bit pending what amount of discussion we feel that there will be.
And then additionally, to announce the Ways and Means for a half-hour session on Thursday for the capital investment. Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, looks like we have a Friday Ways and Means meeting. They're forecasting a session this Friday as well. Is that we'll meet after that?
That is correct. Okay. Yeah, there will be another Ways and Means Committee on Friday at 1 o'clock. And on the agenda then would be general assistance medical care. Okay? There's no time. We're hitting the ground running. So have your legs moving. Any other questions? Then the meetings are adjourned. Thank you very much for coming in.